everybody. Welcome back to All Crime, No Cattle. This is the Texas True Crime Podcast that's always at the top of your list. And we should be, because we're putting out a new episode. And I'm here, I'm Shay, and across from me is your favorite bone lady, Miss Erin. Say hi, Erin.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
How was your birthday?
I'm sure it was great. Thank you all for sending me gifts and happy birthday things. It was very nice.
What was your favorite part?
Presents. Cake. Got a good cake this year.
Yeah? Who got you an awesome cake?
I believe it was Nelson, our dog.
No. Yeah, if you want to see pictures of Erin's cake, I'm sure you can find them on our social media.
And by the way, I know that we said we were going to be putting out a regular episode for my birthday week, and we did not.
Mm-mm.
But as you'll see, the case that I'm going to be doing today is a current event. So that's actually kind of part of the reason why I went ahead and waited a few days, because I wanted to try to get as much up-to-date information as possible.
It sounds like a complicated one.
It is fairly complicated. Yeah, for sure. This episode, we're going to do something a little different than anything we've done before. And that is, we're going to cover a current event happening now in Laredo, which has been labeled by law enforcement and the Webb County District Attorney as serial killings. This is something by now that I'm sure you all have heard of, and hopefully we're going to piece together all the information available as of today into one cohesive report on the Laredo serial killings. So hopefully you'll learn something new. With that being said, obviously, I'd like to remind everyone that because of the fact that this is dealing with current events in an ongoing investigation, we know that, one, we don't have all the facts right now, and two, it might come out in the future, weeks, months, or even years from now, that the details we have today might only be partial truths, or maybe misrepresentations or misreporting of the facts. So this is the truth as we know it today. And of course, we will keep you all updated as new things come out about this case, either in future episodes of the regular show or with special Patreon episodes. So for some of our sources this week, we have the Associated Press. Susan Montoya Bryan, she has some of the best info on the alleged perpetrator out there. There was another article by her and Matt Sedensky, which has some of the best info on the victims in this case. The San Antonio Express News has also had good pieces about the victims and have interviewed victims' families, so check that out as well. The Laredo Morning Times, Corpus Christi Caller Times, and the Washington Post have all had good coverage of this case, and I'll be citing other specific sources throughout the episode, and a lot of this information also comes from the arrest warrant and the complaints as well.
I heard you mention the San Antonio Express in there. Yours truly, ACNC, was just in the San Antonio Express. Holla!
Yes, that's true. Go ahead and find that article on social media where we've posted it everywhere. That was exciting.
Definitely.
We did a little interview about women and true crime podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before we really delve into the details, let's first introduce the setting for this episode, because it's the first time we've been here. It's the city of Laredo in Webb County, Texas. Laredo is located on the northern bank of the Rio Grande on the border with Mexico. It's actually mile marker 1 for Interstate Highway 35. Some of the other border towns we've talked about on this show are La Jolla and Brownsville. Most of those are farther down south, right on that southern tip of Texas. And Laredo is west and north of those areas, but still right there on the border.
Yeah, it's on the little hump there in the lower left-hand side of the Texas shape.
Yes, that's correct. Well, Laredo was founded in 1755 by a Spanish colonist named Don Tomas Sanchez, and it was named after a town in Spain. The city has two nicknames. One is the City Under Seven Flags. So what does that mean? Well, we all know the six flags of Texas based on the six nations who have controlled all or parts of Texas in its history. Of course, this is since colonization and not dealing with any of the nations or peoples that lived here before colonization. But seventh grade pop quiz. Can you name the six flags of Texas?
Let's see here. France, Spain, Mexico, United States. Texas, right? The Texas flag when they were the Republic of Texas. That's five, isn't it?
Yep, you're missing one. You're missing the big baddie.
What would it be?
The Confederate States of America.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Boo. But yeah, in chronological order, it's Spain, France, Mexico, the Republic of Texas, and the Confederate States of America, and the United States of America. Well, in Laredo, there was a seventh nation in its history. the Republic of the Rio Grande, which was formed by three Mexican states in 1840.
Huh.
However, the Republic of the Rio Grande was defeated by Mexican troops pretty early on, which is why we probably don't really hear about it. And this flag only flew for 283 days.
They didn't make it to a year.
Not even a year. Today, the city of Laredo uses the flag of the Republic of the Rio Grande as their city flag because it's unique to them. There are actually seven flags over Laredo.
Interesting. I like that.
Yeah. Today, Laredo has a population of about 240,000 people, making it the 10th most populous city in Texas. According to the Laredo Morning Times and the most recent census data, Laredo is 95.6% Hispanic or Latino, making it one of the least ethnically diverse cities in the United States. So this is a city with very strong geographic, historical, economic, and cultural ties to Mexico, which is why the city's second nickname is the Gateway City, i.e. it's the gateway between the U.S. and Mexico. Well, the story of the Laredo serial killings begins with 29-year-old Melissa Ramirez. According to the Corpus Christi Caller Times, Ramirez loved 80s music and the Halloween movie franchise. She loved her two children and having tickle fights with them and watching their favorite cartoons with them. According to the Associated Press, Melissa had gotten into drugs. She'd gotten into some trouble, but she had been trying to get clean, especially for the sake of her children. On September 4th, 2018, so at the beginning of this month, Melissa's body was found off of an isolated country road about 30 miles outside of Laredo. She had been shot in the head multiple times and left where she fell. She had been dead for about a day when she was found, so she had actually been murdered on the 3rd. 10 days after Melissa's murder, 42-year-old Claudine Luera was found a few miles away from where Melissa was killed. She had been shot in the head, but was found alive on the side of the road by a passing motorist. She was rushed to the hospital, but she died later that day. Claudine was a mother of five who adored her children. Just before her death, she had been thrilled to learn that her autistic son had been doing really well in school and had been taking regular classes, according to the New York Times. She had a very strong bond with her family, and her family has been some of the most vocal in this case. A lot of her family has spoken to the press about Claudine and how this case has been handled by the press. Now, at this juncture of the story, I'm now going to note that it's been reported that all of the victims involved in this case were sex workers. When this case was first being reported on, they were all described as sex workers or prostitutes, first and foremost, barely being acknowledged as people. And this is something that's very interesting to me because we've even talked about it on this show, the way we speak of victims and the level of respect we need to have for them, no matter what they did or who they were, is paramount.
Yeah.
And even today in 2018, we're still seeing the same issues come up in how these stories are being told. In fact, after initially reporting this story, the Associated Press had to do some damage control online. On September 16th, they posted a tweet describing how they deleted previous tweets because they had identified the victims as prostitutes rather than women or victims. This came about because of backlash from their previous reporting, especially from the families of the victims.
Wow. Yeah, and the AP is pretty well known for how they report, and it's surprising that they would name the victims that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And the AP, you're going to see, I'm going to cite from them a lot. They did excellent reporting of this case, but it's, again, the way that you're telling the stories of the victims. And now the story did change quickly, and I will say that most articles from all of the news sources out there, after that initial reporting, have been much more delicate and sensitive in reporting about these victims and have even sought to speak to the family members and friends in an effort to represent these women better. So that's very good to see. But it is sad that immediately after hearing about their loved one's death, these families are having to publicly defend them and reprimand the media. They should not have to do that.
That's not right.
Yeah. So, yes, these women were sex workers, but they were not first and foremost sex workers. In fact, that's probably the least important or interesting thing about them as individuals. However, as we'll get into later, they were absolutely targeted by this alleged perpetrator because they were sex workers. As we've said before, and we'll probably say again, they were a part of this very vulnerable and marginalized community, which is all the more reason to be respectful towards them and try to change the way we think and talk about sex work.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the same story we keep hearing over and over.
So let's move back into this story. The sex worker community in Laredo heard about these two women being killed and were obviously very concerned. At this point, Melissa and Claudine's murders hadn't been linked by law enforcement or the media, so it's not clear if people in this community made that connection themselves or if the two deaths just underlined their vulnerability to violence. But the knowledge of these two deaths spread quickly throughout the sex worker community in Laredo. People in the streets were talking about the murders, and they were worried. Now, I want to try to respect this next person's anonymity, so let's just call her E. On the evening of September 14th, a man E knew as David picked her up and took her back to his house. E had known David for about 4 months, so we might be able to assume that she felt at least a little comfortable with him. E said that David had never acted violent or angry before in the period of time she knew him. He was just a regular guy. E had been friends with Melissa and was devastated by the news of her murder. So Melissa's death was at the forefront of her mind, and she began talking about her. But David reacted very strangely to E's comments about Melissa, and the situation apparently grew very tense. We don't know exactly what was said or what happened during this conversation, but we do know from the affidavits that E grew increasingly worried about David's reaction to her bringing up Melissa, to the point where E got so nauseated that she went outside to throw up.
Oh, man.
After this, E and David then got into David's white pickup and made a short trip to a local gas station. As they were stopped in the parking lot, E brought up Melissa once again. But this time, David pulled out a handgun and grabbed E by the shirt. E threw open the door of the truck and began screaming for help, but David's grip on her didn't relax. She was able to pull herself out of her shirt, jump from the truck, and run away.
Whoa.
Luckily, there was a state trooper who just happened to be at the gas station at this exact moment getting gas.
Oh my gosh, that is so lucky.
It is, yeah.
Especially in Laredo. Like, there's not a lot of people that live there in the first place. There's not a lot of people around, and the only person who happens to be there is a state trooper.
Yeah, it was very lucky for her, and then for him, you know, picture this. He's, you know, just fueling up his car, and this woman who's topless, screaming, freaked out, running up to him, telling him that she's just been assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
So just a really horrible situation, but yeah, I'm sure that that was just miraculous feeling for her that there was somebody right there she was able to run to get help. Meanwhile, while E had ran to get help, the man had driven away. So David is in the wind right now. So all of the women's names in this case have been released to the media. You can find this person's name out there. It is available. It's just that this woman is alive and she's trying to recover from this horrible trauma as best she can. So I just don't see the need to use her full name.
Yeah.
It's just not pertinent. So I want to maintain her anonymity as best we can. So that's why we're just going to identify her as E. But E is possibly the only surviving victim in this case.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't want to do any undue harm to her recovery or anything she's going through right now.
Exactly. Yeah. E was able to give investigators a description of the man and his truck. And even more importantly, told the officers where the man lived, because remember, he had just taken her to his house. They checked the records and saw that the owner of the home was a man named Juan David Ortiz. Now, this description of Ortiz comes mostly from the Associated Press. Ortiz is 35 years old and was a supervisory border patrol agent. Ortiz went into the Navy in 2001, almost immediately after turning 18, and served as a combat medic for 8 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So he saw some rough stuff.
That's possible for sure. Now, upon his discharge, he briefly considered becoming a police officer, and according to the San Antonio TV station KSAT, he was actually approved to enter the academy with the San Antonio Police Department. Instead, he decided to become an agent for the Border Patrol. The U.S. Customs and Border Patrol is a federal law enforcement agency. According to its website, the Border Patrol is, quote, focused 24/7 on securing our international land borders and coastal waters, safeguarding the American people from terrorists and their weapons, drug smuggling, and illegal entry of undocumented aliens. There are just under 20,000 Border Patrol agents in the country, and they are very ubiquitous in a lot of towns along the border, including Laredo.
Yeah. And, you know, I recently went to Del Rio, which is another border town not extremely far from there. But the first thing I noticed when I went into town, just all the Border Patrol vehicles everywhere.
Yeah, there's supposed to be almost, you know, possibly more prevalent than just regular police officers or law enforcement agencies. They're everywhere. They're a part of the community. Everybody knows a Border Patrol agent, you know, who's their friend or family member or whatever. You know, it's very much a part of the culture along the border.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ortiz's decision to join the Border Patrol was a pretty easy one, considering the sweet deal they gave him due to his military service. They offered him a higher rate of pay, and per the Associated Press and KSAT, quote, he would be able to count his 8 years in the military toward the 20 years he'd need to retire with benefits, including a lifetime pension. So instead of having to work for 20 years with the Border Patrol to retire, he would only need to work 12.
Yeah.
Which is pretty incredible. This guy was, you know, in his late 20s going into a job, only having to work 12 years before he can retire.
And I imagine also this is how it works with other government employees, but your time in service at the military also gives you not only a higher rate of pay, but a higher bump in your service grade. So you're that much closer to your next service grade.
Of getting like future
promotions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So overall, it's just that's why a lot of veterans end up going into federal service.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
So Ortiz joined the Border Patrol in 2009. He got his bachelor's degree from American Military University and even his master's degree from St. Mary's University in 2013 while working as a Border Patrol agent.
Oh, wow. He got a master's, though.
Yeah, he has a master's degree. I don't remember exactly what his degrees were in, because I didn't even write it down, so I apparently didn't think it was that interesting. But there you go. He did get it. He did have a master's degree.
Well, that's impressive.
Yeah. At the present, Ortiz has been a Border Patrol agent for almost 10 years, so pretty close to that retirement age where he'd be able to retire with a full pension and be pretty much set for the rest of his life and do whatever he wanted. He was a supervisory officer. He had a wife, two children, and lived in the San Ysidro Ranch subdivision, a quiet suburban neighborhood in Laredo. And it's at this house that the state troopers show up looking for Ortiz in relation to the assault on E. Of course, Ortiz wasn't there. But what law enforcement didn't know is that by this time, Ortiz had allegedly returned to his house and stocked up on a bunch of firearms.
Oh.
And that's because he knew that something bad was about to go down, and he was looking for a fight. He wanted to go out in a blaze of glory.
Oh, so we're thinking death by cop or something.
Absolutely, something that like was that. What he was intending on. He knew that E could provide a description of both himself, his vehicle. She knew where he lived. You know, he knew that this was the end for him. So it's from what we know, it looks like he pretty much immediately went to his house right after E escaped from him, grabbed some weapons, and then took back off in his truck.
Yeah, he knew what was up. The jig was up. The veil was pulled away.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So meanwhile, armed with this guy's name and information, the police put out a be on the lookout for Ortiz. This is just after midnight on the 15th. About 3 hours after E escaped her captor's truck.
And he's still in that truck.
Yes, he's still in the truck. About an hour later, at 1:02 a.m., Ortiz was located at a gas station. To be clear, this was a different gas station than the one that E escaped at. They approached Ortiz as he left the store, but he fled on foot, leaving his truck, along with all of his weapons, behind. Then, at 2:30 a.m., the state troopers, sheriff's office, and some Texas Rangers located Ortiz once again. This time he was hiding in the parking garage of a nearby hotel called Hotel Ava. According to the Corpus Christi Caller Times, he was actually hiding in the bed of a random truck when he was discovered. It's not clear what led them to track him down at this location, like how they got where he was. This be on the lookout was out for him and some police officer saw him or...
Or
you know,
they were just
combing
the area.
Exactly. Yeah. So we don't know exactly how they found him.
But he was hiding in the back of a truck, huh?
That's right.
Just an open truck bed? Like not even with a
camper? I think
so. Wow.
That's my understanding. Okay. As they approached him, Ortiz pulled out a cell phone and, according to law enforcement, attempted to flash the phone in a way to make it look as if he was holding a gun. Basically, they're like, he was absolutely trying to go suicide by cop at this point.
He didn't want to get apprehended.
Nope. And remember, he had all of those weapons, but he had left them back in his truck, so he didn't have actually anything on him. They were able to arrest Ortiz without incident for aggravated assault and evading arrest.
Wow. Great. Good job.
Yeah. So after his arrest and reading him his Miranda rights, investigators started interrogating Ortiz. The Washington Post reported that Webb County and Zapata County District Attorney Isidro Alanis said that initially, Ortiz refused to cooperate with questioning until detectives asked him to, quote, do the right thing. It was then that Ortiz asked them to remove his handcuffs, to which they obliged, and he began to talk. And Juan David Ortiz confessed to the murders of Melissa and Claudine and to the assault on E. So this is what Ortiz confesses. He said, on September 3rd, he picked up Melissa and began driving her out of town. After about half an hour, she told him she needed to urinate, and he pulled off on a country road. Ortiz approached her from behind and shot her multiple times in the head. He left her body, got back into his truck, and drove off. With Claudine, Ortiz confessed a very similar MO. He said he picked up Claudine and drove her a short way out of the city. Now, according to Ortiz, Claudine told him that she thought he had been the last person to be with Melissa before she was murdered. It's not super clear whether or not he had planned on killing Claudine anyway, or something about this accusation set him off.
Like he's trying to cover his tracks.
Exactly. We don't know. But either way, Ortiz said that he then pulled his truck over, Claudine got out, and he shot her in the head.
Just right there on the side of the road.
Yes. According to D.A. Alanis, this confession was given in a very unemotional way. He's just completely indifferent as he's describing allegedly killing two women and assaulting a third. However, he wasn't done there. He continued to confess to the murders of two other women. These murders occurred during the time between E's escape from him at 9 p.m. on September 14th and his arrest at 2:30 a.m. on September 15th. That's right. In this period of about 5 hours, Ortiz allegedly killed two more women.
What?
Yeah.
So while he's trying to escape and get death by cop, he just decides to go ahead and murder two more women.
That's right.
Okay.
The first was Griselda Hernandez Cantu. Unfortunately, we don't know much about Griselda. Remember, this happened 2 weeks ago. But I do know that she was 34, she had four children, and she came from a big family. According to his confession, Ortiz picked Griselda up, drove them down I-35 to the outskirts of Laredo, told her to exit the truck, and shot her multiple times in the head. Her body had just been discovered at about 1 a.m. on September 15th, so around the time that the police had first spotted Ortiz at that gas station is around the time that Griselda's body was found.
Whoa, okay.
He then went back into town, picked up another woman who went by the names Janelle Ortiz, no relation obviously, or Nikki Enriquez. It seems like she went by Janelle with friends and by Nikki with family, and most media sources are using the name Nikki, so I'll follow suit and call her Nikki as well. Nikki was a 28-year-old trans woman who dreamed of being famous one day. According to the Caller Times, her mother described her as high-spirited, never mad, and always smiling.
That sucks. And she's a trans woman. Man, okay. Another woman from a vulnerable population.
Yeah, exactly. Ortiz allegedly did the same thing he'd done before. He took her out of town, within a few miles of where Griselda had just been murdered, told her to get out, and then shot her once in the back of the head. Nikki's body, however, had not yet been found at the time of Ortiz's confession. He was able to tell investigators exactly where he had killed her, and they were able to locate her body based on his confession. She was found in an area of gravel pits off mile marker 15 on I-35. There was a single spent bullet casing nearby. So Ortiz's confession led directly to the recovery of Nikki's body. So I know this is a lot of information happening very quickly, so let's reiterate what we know from this case. Ortiz allegedly killed Melissa Ramirez on September 3rd, Claudine Luera on September 13th, and attacked E on September 14th. Between this attack at 9 p.m. and 2:30 a.m. the next morning when he was arrested, that's a 5.5 hour window, he allegedly murdered both Griselda Hernandez Cantu and Nikki Enriquez. And truly, we can probably whittle that time frame down to about between 9 p.m. and 1 a.m., just 4 hours, because according to the information we have from law enforcement, he still had his truck during the murders of Griselda and Nikki. And we know that he left his truck behind at the gas station at that time when the cops first approached him at 1 a.m.
Yeah, when he escaped on foot. He spent the rest of the time looking for a hiding space.
Yes.
That's a lot of murder in a short span.
Yes, it is. E said that she had known Ortiz for several months before he pulled the gun on her. We don't know what kind of relationship he had with Melissa or Claudine, because obviously the full details of his confession have not been released, but it's suggested everywhere that this wasn't the first time he had met either of them. So it's possible that Melissa and Claudine had also known him for some time and had let their guard down around him. Now, what is their relationship exactly? The only thing that I can figure out is he was a John of all of these women, and that's how he actually knew them. Mm-hmm. But again, that's right now it's kind of speculation, but that's my understanding as to what their relationships were like.
That seems reasonable.
Unlike the first three victims, it's less clear about whether or not Ortiz knew Griselda or Nikki before this night, and it seems probable that these two women were targeted completely at random. Webb County District Attorney Isidro Lanas told the Associated Press, quote, "There appears to have been a history between Ortiz and this community, a community that is vulnerable, defenseless, and has no voice." Webb County Sheriff's Office Chief Deputy Federico Garza also said, quote, "All the victims were defenseless, and at one point Ortiz worked to gain their trust and then viciously shot them." So, what were Ortiz's actions after escaped from him? We've talked about it a little. Let's get into a few more details that we know. Ortiz knew his time was going to be up soon. We already talked about that. He knew that they were going to come looking for him, and he knew that E knew where he lived, and that would be the first place that they'd come looking for him. Well, we also know that Ortiz was fully aware of the situation he was in because of two Facebook posts he made soon after E escaped. The first said, "Doc Ortiz checks out. Farewell." Doc was apparently his nickname as a medic in the Navy. The second, posted minutes after, read, "To my wife and kids, I love you." Now, both of these posts were released by the prosecutor's office. I, of course, immediately went to his Facebook to try to check it out. However, at some point after his arrest, this Facebook account was pretty much scrubbed of all information besides a couple of pictures. It's either been locked down completely so nothing can be seen by the public, or someone went in and basically deleted everything. But we do have the screenshots of these two posts that he made that night. So Ortiz knew he was screwed, that he attacked E at gunpoint, and he knew that they were probably going to look at him for the murder of at least Melissa Ramirez as well at this point. So what did he do? Did he run? Did he try to cross the border and get away? Did he say goodbye in person to his friends and family? No, he spent the last hours he knew he'd have as a free man allegedly abducting and killing two more women. That, my friends, is a monster of epic proportions.
Seriously, why? I don't get it. You're just trying to cause as much damage and destruction as possible before you move before on to caught. The next plane.
Yep.
Because you're planning on being shot by the police.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That is sick, man.
Yeah. So Ortiz is currently being held on a $2.5 million bond. And according to the Associated Press, he is on suicide watch. He's being charged with 4 counts of murder, aggravated assault, and unlawful restraint. There was a rumor that got started on social media that Ortiz posted bond and had been released last week. However, that was not factual, and Ortiz remains in Webb County jail.
Yeah, that would be shocking.
Yeah, hopefully he cannot get the money together to post that bond. Ugh. Well, amongst all the unanswered questions is a question we always ask when we hear of something like this happening, and one you just asked yourself. Why? As I said, we don't know the full details of Ortiz's confession, but we do have some indication of his motivation based on what people involved in the case have said to the media. And according to these people, Ortiz felt contempt towards sex workers and deliberately targeted them for this reason. Webb County Judge Tano Tejerina is quoted by USA Today as stating that Ortiz told investigators that he wanted to, quote, eradicate all the prostitutes. Judge Tejerina went on to say, quote, "I believe Ortiz targeted all victims due to their profession." So we have the age-old story of a man in a position of power and authority who is full of rage and wants to kill. So he begins targeting women in these communities and then justifying his murders because they were sex workers.
Yep.
And thankfully, he was caught early on, or he almost undoubtedly would have continued to kill.
I mean, this is the same story that's been going on since Jack the Ripper, right?
Yes. You are exactly right. Now, Ortiz is certainly not the first Border Patrol agent who has been charged with violent crimes, and not the first one even in Laredo. Ronald Anthony Burgos Aviles, another Border Patrol supervisor from Laredo, was charged with the murder of his girlfriend, Griselda Hernandez, and her one-year-old son, Dominic Alexander Hernandez, back in April of this year. He was indicted on 2 counts of murder, and prosecutors have announced that they will be seeking the death penalty in that case.
Jeez.
So right now, the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol Agency is falling all over itself trying to answer the multiple questions being thrown at them from citizens, the media, and politicians about whether or not the increasing number of Border Patrol agents over the last few years has meant that the CBD has lowered its standards, allowing violent, abusive people into the fold.
It's a really good question to ask because I know people have been reporting on this since way back in Bush's administration when he started ramping up the border control. Mm-hmm. And they basically had to start just going out and taking a lot more candidates into the Border Patrol than they normally would. They didn't have as much time to vet people thanks to 9/11 and this big rush to stock the border with, you know, as many Border Patrol officers as possible. So this is probably some of the backlash that we're seeing from all this.
Yeah, and it's the same question that we're having about all law enforcement agencies when you really need to go out and push for getting people hired. Are you using the same standards that we would expect you to be using?
Hopefully you would be increasing your vetting standards annually and as we move forward into the future.
One would hope. Well, to this, the CBD has been saying, no, their standards are just as high as ever. And with 20,000 people employed as Border Patrol agents, there's bound to be a few bad apples. Some of the victims' families have also come to the defense of the Border Patrol, stating that Ortiz's action should not reflect badly upon the rest of the agency. As for the CBD itself, it is fully cooperating with the investigation into the murders.
I mean, that's all well and good, but with this kind of destruction and rampage, there's bound to be something in his past and something in his military history. Somebody who knew him closely that could have raised red flags on an FBI background check.
And that's actually what we're going to continue seeing. That's part of the investigation that we're going to be seeing come out in the future. Here's one aspect of it. It doesn't appear that Ortiz was in uniform during any of these alleged crimes, or that he was on company time, or that he used government vehicles or weapons during the commission of the acts.
Oh, so he didn't use a service weapon.
We do not believe so. Everything that I just listed is still being investigated right now.
Okay, because that was one of my questions.
Yeah. At the very least, however, he did use his knowledge as a Border Patrol agent to find these remote areas outside of town to kill these women. Ortiz was on the highway interdiction team that was focused on drug and human trafficking along I-35. Where were all these women killed?
Along
I-35.
Wow.
As an agent, he was also privy to a certain amount of intel on the investigation as well. For example, according to the Corpus Christi Caller-Times, Judge Tijerina stated that police were mistakenly looking for a black Cadillac sedan in relation to one or both of the first two murders. Ortiz was aware of this, so he knew that they had nothing on him, which, who knows, might have contributed to his cockiness in continuing to kill. Yeah. So he had some amount of knowledge from his position to evade detection and to keep an eye on the investigation. On top of this investigation into the CBD and into his activities as a Border Patrol agent, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, or the NCIS, is also joining the investigation with law enforcement by looking into his history and service record while he was in the Navy.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so this is according to NavyTimes.com. As of now, there doesn't seem to be any indication of criminal activity while he was in the Navy. Based on anything that we know that has been released to the public, obviously.
Well, if there is, NCIS will find it.
Yeah.
Because they're badasses.
Exactly. And they're not providing any details about their investigation right now or anything that they've potentially found. But yeah, they are doing their due diligence and tracking down additional information on this guy, peering into his past to see if he's possibly connected to any other crimes.
That'll be interesting to see what comes out of all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we wind down this episode, there are a couple of things that I think are worthy discussion points. And those are, one, are these his first murders? And two, if they are, should this really be described as serial killings? So again, law enforcement has identified these murders as serial killings. So that's something that they have stated to the media. They are identifying this person as a serial killer. As we know, there are a few definitions of what a serial killer is by a few different agencies, including the FBI and the National Institute of Justice, and these definitions have evolved over the years. But basically, what we know as serial murder is usually defined as at least two, perhaps three murders that are sexually sadistic and occur over a span of time with an emotional cooling off period in between each murder. this element of a time span and the sexual gratification aspect are usually token aspects of a serial killer that set them apart from things like mass murders and spree killers.
And that's also part of the cooling off period that you mentioned, because they have to wait
a while. The time span, yes. Yeah. The time span. So there's a certain span of time of the murders in their entirety, but also a time span between each murder. So it's not like with a spree killer, you're enraged and you're just killing everybody you want to.
Yeah, Charles Whitman.
Yes, in this kind of one act of outrage. Like, you're mad and you're angry as a serial killer. You go out and kill. That calms you down. And then it builds back up again. And then you go out and kill again. And that's kind of the difference between, you know, some of these definitions that we have for these kinds of murders.
Yeah, and that's why he doesn't really fit that.
Well, yeah. I mean, of the four murders, the longest period between the two was 10 days. That's between Melissa Ramirez and Claudine Loero. There was no emotional cooling off period that is token for a serial murder, as far as it seems. So could this be better classified as a spree killer? According to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, a spree killer is defined as killings at two or more locations with almost no time break in between the murders. So to me, that's a better fit.
Yeah.
That's a better description.
Especially for the end of the ramp up. You know, all that 5-hour window we talked about that was really just a 4-hour
window. Really a 4-hour window, yeah.
Man, there was a lot of destruction in those 4 hours.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, this is just kind of mincing words. It's an interesting discussion point. I don't think law enforcement really places that much value in these descriptors. And
it's interesting to talk about.
Yeah. Though. I mean, these categories, they're fluid. They're not super defined anyway. It's interesting for us, for true crime people, I think, to like kind of talk about these categories. So yeah, tell us what you guys think. Is what we've described in this episode, is it serial murder in your opinion, or is it spree killing?
Yeah, without knowing his early days at this point.
Yes, and so that leads into my second question is, are these his first murders? Mm-hmm. Like Bundy, was Ortiz, during the month of September 2018, was he going into this berserker mode? And is this the final events of a long string of murders?
Yeah.
We don't know. I mean, this is the thing. If he had killed before, why would he admit to 4 murders, including Nikki? Remember, they hadn't even recovered her body. But why would he not then also admit to other previous murders? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's hard to believe that if he had just started this string of murders out of nowhere with no previous crimes, that's very difficult to believe, but it's also totally possible.
Yeah.
So these are some of the questions that are swirling around this case. This is all speculation right now.
I need to know about his youth and the McDonald Triad information.
Yeah. Yeah. All of that stuff hopefully will come out later, and it'll be interesting to figure that out. Well, let's go back, though, to the important people of this case, which is the victims. A candlelight vigil for the victims was held on September 19th on San Bernardo Avenue in Laredo. This is the street where basically he picked up all of these women. And in all of this pain and grief for the events that just happened, and like, I want to underline that, these women were just taken away from their family and friends this month. This is breaking current events. I mean,
yeah, it's a fresh wound for sure.
It's so awful. And these women's families have been outspoken and brave, and they have put the media in their place. They've organized vigils for all of the victims. And it's just so incredible to see, because it's hard to imagine how devastated and angry they must be.
Yeah.
And I mean, these women's families are incredible. I can't say enough about how they've just done such a service to their family members by the way that they've spoken about them and spoken to the media. And I mean, it's just incredible work they've done, and work that they shouldn't have to do. And I think, you know, it's frustrating, but it's also really beautiful that they've felt they've had like the power to say these things and to reprimand the media. And then the media is coming around and saying, you know what, you're right, we're really sorry, we're going to do this different.
Yeah.
And it's something that I don't think we would have seen, like, you know, 20 years ago or something.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing to have a community and the family of the victims come together in such a way to start the healing process together, as such a tight-knit community as Laredo is. And also that they all come from a similar background, and I think that probably helps, you know.
Probably.
It probably helps unite them on a front that they have togetherness, you know, and they need to stand up for each other.
Yeah. At that vigil, Claudine's niece, Karina, had this to say, quote, They mentioned that he targeted these people for a reason. We don't know that reason, but I think he thought nobody cared about them. But everybody here today shows that they are loved and they will be missed. So, as I said, we will follow this case. We'll keep you posted. It's going to be a while before he's formally indicted, and even longer before the case will go to trial, if it actually does. We have no idea at this point if he'll plead guilty or not. If he does choose to fight the charges, it'll be interesting to see what his defense will be, considering that the whole fact of his confession leading directly to the recovery of Nikki's body. I'm not sure how you're going to, you know, defend against that.
Maybe but insanity. I don't know.
Yeah. So we'll definitely see how everything shakes out. And finally, I want to leave off with a quote from Claudine's sister from the Associated Press. She said, "They had families. They were loved. They were someone. They were human." And I think that's a really beautiful sentiment about these women and about this entire case.
And they're sharing that with the whole world. They're a vessel for change with the way the media is covering these cases.
Absolutely.
And they're doing good. Let's not let these victims disappear into the desert air of Laredo. Let's do something with what happened.
Yeah.
Let's change the way we view these crimes. And it's not something that doesn't happen anymore. This is still going on today.
Very much so. Yeah.
One of the cases we've covered that this guy really reminds me of is Kenneth L. McDuff. I know we've referenced that case a lot in this show, but, you know, the way that Kenneth L. McDuff would go down to the cut in Waco and prey on drug addicts and sex workers, and he knew from his association with the city police that they didn't really care about these women whatsoever. And that was years and years ago, decades ago, and it's still happening today.
Yeah, I mean, something actually reminded me of the very same case is when we first put out our episodes on the Broomstick Killer, of course, you guys know that we always put out pictures of the victims, either in video or we just post their pictures. And so we were going through everything that we could find, trying to find pictures of his victims. And we noticed that in every case where it was a sex worker, not only could we barely find any information on those individuals at all, but the only pictures we could find of them were mugshots.
Yep.
So, you know, you had cases where these women are basically personalityless. They're not individuals. They're just labeled as a sex worker. And nobody did any due diligence to try to find out any more about them. So although this case was frustrating in the very beginning of when it was being reported, we immediately saw that change into where we have so much information on these women, even though these murders just happened. The families have come out and told us about them. And even though we see these similarities in the fact that we have a bad guy targeting these vulnerable people, we're seeing it at least play out differently. We're seeing people talk about it differently. And so there is a silver lining, I think, when we're talking about this case, in that we actually see these women as victims, as people, rather than, oh, well, they're sex workers, they're just criminals. So, you know, they kind of deserved it, which is always what it's been, you know, kind of relegated to in the past. And at the very least, we know he targeted these women because he clearly hates women. And, you know, if you hate women, what's the best population to go after? A lot of times it's sex workers because you don't think that you're going to get caught.
Exactly.
And again, this is an issue with the predators who prey upon those kinds of people and not with the people themselves.
Man, what a good case. And you did such a good job.
Thank you. Yeah, it was hard.
It's very current.
This is very up to date. I did, before we even recorded, I went and did another quick search to make sure nothing else has come out. And so this is pretty much at the time of this recording. This is what we know, what we think, you know, to be true at this point. So obviously a lot of unanswered questions right now, but also we seem to know a lot at the same time. And so
the AP's definitely been doing a really good job in the local media at putting a lot of stuff out there.
Yeah.
They need to correct a lot of the way they put stuff out there, but they have been covering it pretty thoroughly.
Yes. Yeah, I'd agree with that as well.
Oof. That was a tough one, man.
Yeah.
Really sad. But, you know, the one thing we can do on our show is flip-flop to the other side of the coin and give you something extremely uplifting to make you feel better. So we'll be right back after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. This is the part of the show we like to call good news. And today's good news comes from Austin360.com. And this story is pretty great, and you're going to like this, Aaron. You're going to have a family tie-in to this. Basically, this is about an organization called Honor Flight Austin. And what this organization basically does is they do a lot of fundraising and crowdsourcing to get money together to send veterans on a short weekend trip to Washington, D.C., when these veterans have never been and never seen some of the national monuments and memorials for fallen soldiers and veterans. And I think that's just an awesome thing to do. Just recently, on September 24th, in Austin Bergman International Airport, a sort of a parade started in a terminal. You know how, like, when you're in the airport, it's pretty bustling. Everybody's kind of focused on getting to their plane and their terminal and getting checked in and getting all settled. Well, everything pretty much just stopped as a bagpiper comes marching down the terminal, playing the bagpipes, and there's this big procession of honor guard and everyone who's helping these soldiers. They have them all in wheelchairs, basically. Not because they're not mobile per se, but just it's nice to like escort them to their plane. Each military veteran had a handler, basically, who would provide everything that they needed. They had all of their boarding passes. They had everything set up. They took care of them during security. They got them to their terminal. They helped them through the procession in this little mini parade. And basically, yeah, they get on this plane and they head off to Washington, D.C., and they're set up with a hotel. They're set up with all their tours, and they're all together. And they get to spend time with other servicemen and women from different branches of the military who were involved in similar campaigns. So yeah, just imagine the scene in this airplane terminal. People are stopping with their, like, rolling business bags. And all of a sudden, people are just weeping with tears and saluting and shaking these men and women's hands as they go by. They actually sang the national anthem when they all got on the plane. Everyone stood up. And there's other people on this plane who are just commuting to Washington, D.C. Everyone on the plane stood up and sang the national anthem together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was pretty amazing. And Honor Flight Austin is a nonprofit organization that you can go and donate to, and I'll definitely put their information and where you can go to help these people out. It's a really great organization.
So are they honoring veterans of certain campaigns or certain wars, or is it just basically something that honors any military veteran?
So what the organization tries to do is they try and group certain campaigns, different military campaigns together. So they don't want just one person from the Korean War or just one person from World War II. They try and find other people in the area or in the state so that they can go together. Sometimes it's kind of like a hodgepodge of a lot of different military campaigns, but you'll at least have some other people that served in the same one that you were in. And they said specifically this is really important for veterans of Vietnam, and that's the group that they really try and serve with Honor Flight, because a lot of those soldiers, when they came back home after Vietnam, they received a terrible welcome home. And it wasn't fair to them. They were just doing their job, serving their country. And now they get to have the procession, the parade, you know, people coming up to them wanting to shake their hand. And I'm kind of tearing up talking about it, but it's just emotional. It's like, it's really heartwarming for these Vietnam veterans. And they speak out a lot talking about how much this helps them and how much this actually links them up to other people who have experienced the same kind of things once they came home from the war, and how meaningful this trip is. So it's a really great cause, and I highly recommend you check it out. And like I said, we'll link the article as well as the places you can go and donate.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Well, now we're going to switch over to our recommendation section of the show, and we've got a really cool show that I think you're going to like. And, you know, it's Halloween. It's the time of the season where everything gets a little darker.
The best time of the year.
It's a little spookier. Everybody's wearing creepy masks and costumes. Well, this show that I'm going to recommend to you is The Nowhere Dispatch, and this is run by our friend Lucas. and he hosts and produced the show. And it's
from right here in the great state of Texas.
That's right. And he's behind the pines, as Krista would say, from Lone Star Law and Disorder. He's in East Texas, behind the pine curtain. And he likes to talk about, you know, any kind of creepy thing that goes bump in the night in East Texas. And he brings it to you with some really amazing skills of research, mythology, legends. I mean, I just listened to his Mayacosa episode about the East Texas Bigfoot, basically. And he went all the way back to Cabeza de Vaca's first journals when he arrived, and which are largely considered some of the first manuscripts that we have of an outsider documenting Native Americans here in Texas. And he goes back to those documents and cites those as the first time we ever hear about East Texas Bigfoot from the Native Americans. And so, man, he does a deep dive in research. And it's not just cryptids. It's true crime. It's all kinds of weird stuff, different topics. Basically, if it freaks you out and it makes you scared, he wants to cover it. And what I love about Lucas is he'll give you all of his research and everything he's found. He'll present it. He'll present the facts. He'll present, you know, maybe the supposition, the opinions, and the folklore. But then he lets you decide what you think.
Yeah.
He doesn't go off on a conspiracy theory or, you know, his own personal reasoning and, you know, ideas. And that makes it even creepier for me.
Yeah, I really like it because it's almost like Last Podcast on the Left, which, you know, I've talked about that show before. It's my favorite podcast in existence. It's kind of like that, where he talks about weird stuff, paranormal, cryptids, true crime. But it's presented as if it's like lore. And obviously, Everybody Loves Lore. It's a very big podcast. I think it's something that a lot of people would really enjoy.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Like you said, really well researched. Lucas is a good guy. He's one of our buddies.
He's got a great voice. The sound's great.
Yeah.
And he does a lot of really cool, interesting, creepy music that he lays underneath it while he's delivering the narrative.
Yeah, it really like gets you into these.
It freaks you out.
In the creepy mood.
I'm telling you, that East Texas Bigfoot one, like, I think Bigfoot's stupid, but that episode creeped me the heck out.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Go check out Lucas's show. And I think it's perfect for October.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll let you hear from Lucas right now.
When you stare into the woods in the stillest part of the night, what stares back at you? When your car tires kick up dust on a lonely red dirt road, what will you find waiting for you at the end? What if you had the chance to explore the legends you heard growing up, the half-remembered stories told around a campfire, and the rumors which can't possibly be true? My name is Lucas. Here on the Nowhere Dispatch podcast, follow me into the middle of the deepest, darkest reaches of the place I call home, East Texas. It's filled with history, heresy, blood, riches, and mysteries long unsolved. Among the pines, things can get very weird. Listen in on Megaphone, iTunes, and all your favorite podcast apps. Follow me on Twitter at Nowhere Dispatch for updates and links to new episodes. Come with me, dear listener, and I'll guide you straight into the middle of nowhere.
All right, welcome back. Now it's time for us to pay up on all of our fan debts to you, ACNC Posse. We owe you some shout-outs. We're still doing shout-outs. We're probably going to be doing shout-outs for a while because we're behind. But as far as shout-outs go, you know from now on, you're going to have to donate to the Patreon to get a shout-out. And you can find our Patreon page over at patreon.com/allcrimenocattle. We've talked about this a little bit, and we're really proud of the Patreon. We're starting to get a lot of the stuff in for our Patreon supporters, and you're going to be receiving that this month in October.
In fact, our buttons with our brand new logo literally just came in while we were recording this episode.
That's right, and they are looking sweet.
Yeah, I like them. I think they turned out well.
Yeah, and we got our enamel pins coming soon. Aaron's on top of the pet bandanas, so go over to our Patreon page and figure out what tier works for you and how you'd like to support the show, and we'll send all of your goodies out this month.
Yes, and regardless of whether or not you're a Patreon member, next month for our Halloween episode, we're going to be doing, of course, we're going to be talking a little bit more about the case of Ahmed Al-Jumaili, which was a case that we did a couple of episodes ago. We're going to go into some fine details on that.
And boy, do we have a lot to talk about.
Oh, yes. But we're also going to be doing some Halloween creepy stories. So if you have a creepy story, paranormal, weird crime thing, scary, spooky, creepy, I already said that, but you know, all that weird stuff. Send that over to us at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com, and we will be reading those stories for our creepy Patreon Halloween episode. Ooh.
That's right. So get those in.
You can also find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast. You can find us on Instagram at allcrimenocattle. And of course, I already said our Gmail account, allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. And remember, if you're like, I need to buy a present to somebody who's smart and cool and funny and beautiful, probably, then remember, we have a Threadless shop just for them. It's allcrimenocattle.threadless.com. Go check it out.
Yeah, there's some really cool stuff there. We're selling t-shirts every day, along with travel mugs, everything.
Well, our first 5-star reviews come to us from Facebook, and this one is from Stephanie Shelley, who says, currently binge listening, but loving what I'm hearing. I lived in DFW all my life until 1 year ago when life took me to Indiana. I love the Texas-only cases and hearing cases that not every other podcast has done. Love the banter of the husband and wife team, and the research is incredible. I feel like you both care about the victims, but can keep things light when they need to be and heavy when it counts. Keep up the good work, and I'll keep listening. Oh, cow joke.
Oh, cow joke.
Hee-haw! Oh, God. All right. What do you call a sleeping cow?
Let's see. A sleeping cow. I don't know. You're going to have to tell me.
A bulldozer. That's a good one. I like it a lot.
That's a dad joke.
Oh, all of these are jokes.
Cow jokes are dad jokes.
That's why they're the best. You know Shay's excited when he busts out his stupid
sound
little
machine.
Sound thing. The next one is from Allison Lee, who says, Shea Butter and Aaron, thank you for always producing a good show. Each time an episode ends, I wish I hadn't binged when I first discovered your show because I have to wait an entire week for the next one. Thank you for always showing compassion to the victims and for your in-depth research. I also love the good news section. It's a great palate cleanser. Keep up the great work. Thank you very much, Allison.
You know what they say, Allison. Absence makes the heart grow fonder.
That's right. Scotty Nichols says, I love this podcast and you guys are great. Keep up the great work. Your neighbor to the east in Longview, Texas.
Woo-woo, Longview, what up?
What up, Scotty? Ruth Ann Holcomb says, totally love the show. Love the cases y'all have covered so far. Keep them coming. We will try to do that, Ruth Ann.
Hey, sometimes life gets in the way, but you know, we're doing pretty good. We haven't taken a lot of weeks off. We've been banging them out pretty steady this year.
Oh, Lordy. And it's hard, but we do it for the love of you guys.
But thankfully, we just got a new researcher that you're going to be hearing from in the upcoming episodes, and that should help alleviate some of the burden, hopefully. And we'll let you know more about them in the future. But hey, if you want to read a book for us, let me know. I got plenty of them you can read.
Audrey Dingler Eldridge says, I've just binged your podcast while building a fire pit.
Oh, wow.
Y'all got me through this backbreaking project in the mid-July Arkansas heat.
Oh, why are you doing it now?
Glad this project is over, but I'm sad I have caught up to the podcast. Love your chemistry and hard work. Aaron, I also cross-stitched too. Oh, ooh, keep up the good work. And then she also posted a picture of two dogs next to her brand new fire pit she just built. And it's amazing.
Oh, wow.
So go check out that for Audrey's super cute doggos and her very cool fire pit. That's going to be amazing come winter.
Yeah, when it's not a million degrees outside.
Yeah.
But hey, cross-stitch sister.
Yeah.
High five.
Emily Mitchell Hollister says, I love this podcast. So glad I found you. And I'm excitedly binging. Keep them coming. Thank you, Emily.
Very similar to the last one.
And what do you think? Like one more?
Yeah.
And the last one comes from Terry Kohler Willis, who says, very interesting show, and I love the way they take turns presenting the case, so it's more interactive than if they both knew all the facts of the case. I need to catch up on episodes since I was late to the game and listening. Keep up the great work. Well, Terry, that just means that eventually you're going to catch up and you're going to hear that our review that we just read that you wrote. Terry, what you doing now? Terry, are you still listening, Terry?
Terry.
What if Terry decided that she hates the show?
Oh, God, Terry.
Terry.
Come back.
Terry, are you there?
Come
are you
back still to us, there? Terry.
Oh, I'm always so worried about that.
Yeah.
Terry, hope you're still here with us.
Hey.
Let us know, Terry, if you're out there.
Yeah, get back to us, Terry. All right, switching over to iTunes, we got a few to get through. We got Vina, Vina, Vina.
Hmm.
And they say, saddle up for true crime and humor, y'all. I've been to the Lone Star State before, and with this podcast makes me think of Beyond Southern Hospitality and know-how. Also, I'm going back there for my birthday.
Oh.
Oh, and by the way, this is Rachel. All right, Vina Vina Vina, a.k.a. Rachel, come on back to us. Hang out for a while.
Yeah, although that might have already happened.
Yeah.
If so, happy birthday either way.
Yeah, that was in July, so.
Yeah, who knows?
Hooded Fantasia. No, I'm all caught up. I think that's how they meant for it to go. I started listening Monday and just caught up. I had to put off listening to any of my favorite pods because ACNC is so good. Thank you for doing such a great job. Keep it up. Also, thank you for mentioning Moms and Murder. Been listening from the start, and Mandy and Melissa are so modest and genuine, just like you guys. Man, I love Moms and Murder. They're
awesome.
Yeah,
they're cool.
Yeah, they're real good friends of the show, and you should definitely go check them out if you haven't. But thank you. Thank you for binging.
Oh, yes.
Ann Hensley says, love this podcast. I live in Fort Worth, so these cases are so interesting to listen to, well-researched, and enjoyable to listen to. Thank you, Ann Hensley. Hello, fellow Panther City resident. Funky Town.
Yeah, we've probably been at the same restaurant before, and you wouldn't even know it. We're the two weirdos in the back cackling about fart jokes or something, probably.
And Ted Bundy.
Yeah, it's possible.
Raycab1993 says, love it. I've heard about this podcast from Based on a True Crime, and then I heard a mini episode on the Murderly mashup, and I fell in love. I finally caught up with my other shows, and I'm now binging All Crime, No Cattle. Just what I needed. More murder in my life. Keep it up. Yeah, we love Based on a True Crime. They're really cool.
Yeah, they are.
Sooners Gigi says, outstanding. Mike Morford from Murder in My Family recommended this podcast. Great recommendation. Well-researched and presented. I live in South Central Oklahoma. I couldn't have guessed, Sooners Gigi. And traveled down into Texas frequently. So I always know exactly where the place of the crime is located. Well, thank you, Sooners Gigi. And go OU, I guess. My dad's a Sooners fan. I don't really care about college sports, but
yeah.
go for it.
Yeah, that's fine. And also, thank you to Morph.
Yeah.
Who's one of the greatest guys around.
Yeah, check out Murder in My Family. A lot of shows recommending us recently.
And, of course, Criminology.
Oh, yeah, of course. One of the geniuses behind Criminology.
Yes.
Mrs. Jessica Lopez says, so good. Do you have any relation to J-Lo?
I hope so.
Man, I hope you do. Hook us up with hanging out with J-Lo.
Yeah. And then she can lead us to Shakira, who Shay clearly has a thing for because he
ole, ole,
will not stop ole, talking about Shakira ole. On the show.
I love Shakira. Just started listening and I'm loving this duo. Great storytelling and banter. And last one, Stephanie1234 says, y'all are awesome. Love listening to you guys while I work. You make the day go by so fast. Keep up the awesome work. Thanks from Ohio, the Buckeye State. As we've learned.
Yes, that's right.
All right. And that's it. That's all of our payments due today.
That's it and that's all.
Yep. And Aaron and I are celebrating our dating anniversary tonight.
Oh, yeah. Happy 12 years of romance, love.
Fart jokes.
Yep.
True crime sharing on the patio.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a minute, but I wouldn't change it for the world. I'll say something nice right before Aaron says something mean.
How did you know?
Yeah.
Okay, you know what? I will go against
the grain.
Yeah. And say, also, I'm thrilled and I love you.
That didn't seem genuine at all.
But you know what else I love? I love our listeners. Thank you so much for checking out the show. I hope you enjoy this episode. I hope that you learned something, and we will see you next week for a Shay episode. Shay Butter, you guys love them. The ladies love Shay Butter.
They do. We need to start selling like Shay Butter themed merch.
Okay.
Yeah, like some shirts, maybe some like fanny packs or something. Who doesn't love a fanny pack?
Oh yeah. Okay.
And then maybe like.
But we'll put what was it that I said that one episode? Panty pack.
Oh, panty pack.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll put panty pack and then it'll say Shea Butter approved. I'll be on that. And then I need my own butter. I need Detective Shea's butter.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, no.
The idea of that it's makes just Shea me butter. Want to throw up.
We need to find a company that'll make Shea butter and then I can brand it.
Okay.
Tell us in the comments if you'd be interested in that. Then you could slather my smoothness all over yourself.
Gross. I'm married to you and that grosses me out.
All right, guys. Y'all know what we say. Crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.